Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and to the glory of God and his kingdom. When we talk about protecting the country we love, we often talk about China, communist China, and specifically the Chinese Communist Party that misrules China. It is, of course, at the moment, in the throes of tremendous ferment within China because of some of the latest abuses by the CCP, as it's known, of its own people, specifically COVID lockdowns, brutally repressive means of suppressing a disease, presumably, but in practice, terribly suppressing the people of China. And they're in the streets by very large numbers, and they're calling, among other things, for the end of the regime and the removal of its newly coronated emperor, Xi Jinping. We're going to talk a little bit about some of those in the West who are aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party, helping prop it up, helping legitimate it, indeed, and the kind of criticism that they deserve for doing so. I'm very happy to say our guest for this purpose is our friend Bill Walton, the host of his own television program, The Bill Walton Show, and a man who brings a lot of experience with a sector of our nation that has been very heavily penetrated by the Chinese Communist Party with what they call elite capture. Bill saw some of this up close as the president of Allied Capital during his time on Wall Street. He's observing it very closely as we speak, both with his own program and his visits here, among other places. Bill, so good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Frank, great to be with you.
So, Bill, talk a little bit about one of your former colleagues on the street, Michael Bloomberg. Before he became the mayor of New York, he was, of course, a wildly successful businessman, notably with these terminals, the Bloomberg terminals, that are required equipment for people in the capital markets. Has long and apparently quite extensive ties with communist China and seems to be shilling for them rather feverishly. Give us an example of what he's up to and why.
Well, now that Michael Bloomberg is no longer running for president, he seems to have switched back to his true allegiance, which is Bloomberg Company, which has extensive financial network all over the world, in particular the ubiquitous Bloomberg terminals, of which there are many in China. And at a recent conference, he was joined by Boris Yeltsin, who was the most immediate past prime minister of
Boris Johnson. I
think. Boris Johnson. Boris Yeltsin. Gee, what? anyway, Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson drinks less than Boris Yeltsin. Michael Bloomberg, now that he is no longer running for president, seems to switch his allegiance back to his first love, which is Bloomberg Company. And at a recent conference, Boris Johnson, ex-prime minister of the UK, spoke out quite strongly against both China and Russia in some of his remarks. And he said they've shown a candid disregard for the rule of international law, and they've demonstrated immense limitations of their political systems with disastrous mistakes that they've made. And Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, upon hearing this, felt like he had to engage in damage control. And a day or two later in the conference came up. And by the way, I should add, Michael is chair of Joe Biden's Pentagon Advisory Council and advisory panel. And Bloomberg then announced to the assembled people in the crowd that I know some of you may have been insulted or offended last night by parts of the speaker's remarks referencing certain countries, and this is interesting, and their duly elected leaders. I think President Xi in China would appreciate the nod to democracy. And of course, Bloomberg in 2019 told us that Xi Jinping is not a dictator of China. Rather, he's a democratically elected president. Anyway, he's walked back Johnson's remarks and once again shows his he's firmly in the camp of protecting the Chinese Communist Party. And it's particularly upsetting because of his role. The panel is technically called the Defense Innovation Board at the Department of Defense. And of course, this is our Department of Defense protecting America against the predations of China. And we're not sure which team he's playing
for. At least we hope so. Yeah.
We all wonder which team he's playing for, along with a lot of the other big billionaires doing business in China.
Well, and Bill, that's really where I'd like to go with this is that's not just, you know, something that we might speculate about. That's something we have to be profoundly concerned about. Because to the extent that this isn't just, you know, doing a public shilling, as I say, for China, but reflects a deep-seated, divided loyalty at best, if not a very substantial personal compromise. And he's got this kind of role in the Pentagon, for heaven's sakes, to say nothing of, you know, helping move American investors' funds to China. This is a serious problem that is not unique to Michael Bloomberg, alas, but obviously particularly egregious in his case.
Well, we've got Tim Cook, of course, at Apple. And you mentioned at the outset the demonstrations that are occurring because of the totally inhumane and egregious lockdowns that Xi is engaging in China. And people are streaming into the streets. And of course, in anything like this, you want to be able to communicate with your fellow protesters. Well, Apple, at the behest of the Chinese Communist Party, in the last couple of weeks, has begun limiting the use of Apple's AirDrop. And AirDrop is essentially a ways, and I'm not going to give a complete technical description, but it's a way people can communicate directly phone from phone without going through the internet or through the surveilled state communication networks that China has. And by doing this, he severely limited the protesters' ability to communicate with each other and did it to help the Chinese Communist Party crack down with all the stormtroopers they've got in the streets with their white suits.
Well, and the thing about this AirDrop, as I understand it, Bill, is that it's not just a means of communicating, but it's a means of communicating in a manner that is very difficult to monitor. So
right.
Effectively, what it's doing is kind of a twofer for the Chinese Communist Party. It's helping make the organizing of these protests more difficult, but it's also making it easier for them to use their surveillance state apparatuses to punish those who've participated in these programs, which is something that they're about and they're very ruthlessly doing, I think, as well, and more will come of that. I was very heartened to see Governor Ron DeSantis taking Apple to task for this behavior. I think he called them a vassal for the CCP. Others of us, notably Steve Bannon, have said, you know, they're serving as the national security agency for the CCP. Not that it needs another one, I don't think. But this, again, suggests a real rot, not just in the financial sector, but in American business circles as well. Which brings me to an entity that is promoting much of this through the World Economic Forum in Davos. Klaus Schwab has let the mask slip a little bit in terms of his appreciation for the so-called China model, Bill. What's up with that?
Well, Klaus Schwab, founder of the World Economic Forum, Davos, aka Davos Man, he's been the leader for decades, three, four decades. And he sat down with an interview by the communist.
Bill, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you a bit more about what is now happening vis-a-vis China and ESG as well in Wall Street, right after this.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Eric Metaxas is arguably the most brilliant, principled, and courageous public intellectual of his generation. A serial best-selling author, he's inspired by and powerfully evokes the lives and works of those he's chronicled, particularly a theologian Martin Luther, slavery abolitionist William Wilberforce, and religious freedom champion Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Metaxas has channeled these historically impactful individuals in his newest book, A Letter to the American Church. It warns that U.S. Christian leaders, denominations, and houses of worship are exhibiting shortcomings that resulted in their German counterparts accommodating, submitting to, and ultimately being destroyed by Adolf Hitler's Nazis. America's church and patriots must stand forcefully for religious and other liberties in the face of federal legislation effectively criminalizing their faith's tenets concerning marriage, official lockdowns of their services, and the rising tide of persecution now abusing over 360 million Christians worldwide, and increasingly here. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Bill Walton, the proprietor of The Bill Walton Show and star, of course. He has analysis of Wall Street and business, and more broadly, what's happening in our country is very much appreciated here by us and our audience. And Bill, thank you again for giving us your time. I did want to ask you about one other piece of this business of the sort of global resetters, if you will, Klaus Schwab among them, and the Chinese, the Chinese Communist Party in its fashion, namely the use of something called ESG, environment, social, and governance values, if you will, or priorities, to remake American capitalism, and for that matter, our economy. We've had a very troubling indication of the extent to which this is now being institutionalized in Wall Street from a outfit that I know you're very familiar with, Bain Capital. Talk a little bit about them and how they and folks like Larry Fink and others are at work advancing this so-called ESG agenda.
Well, ESG is something that's inflicted most every single large public company in America and, in fact, in the world. And Bain, along with other major consulting firms like McKinsey, are firmly in the camp of promoting ESG. And many of us thought, including me, that that was something that public companies did because they could afford to as part of their public relations campaign, basically. I didn't think they were serious. Well, it turns out they are serious. And Bain is now promoting this with all the private equity firms that it's advising. And they recently ran an ad in Twitter that explained, talk with Bain and we'll explain to you how to invest ESG investing into every private equity investment you make. Those of us who think that when you invest dollars or whatever capital you're investing, you ought to see a financial return from it. ESG is not a way to get a financial return on your invested capital, and so this these really bad ideas, which have affected the profitability and the returns to shareholders in public companies, have now been moved into the private company world.
Mm-hmm. And, but in both cases, Bill, I think it's kind of reflecting a sort of attitude of elevating stakeholders, as they're called, over the actual investors and shareholders, private or public. And this really hit, I thought that the message was getting out that this is actually not working out so well for those investors. And I would think, especially on the private side, they'd be really gun shy about
this. Well, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the ESG, let's take the E piece of it, the environmental piece. There's no way that environmental, climate change investing is economic unless you're receiving massive subsidies from the government, which in case the Inflation Reduction Act just did, almost $1 trillion in subsidies to
Democratic donors.
Democratic donors. Gee, it's funny how these things all fit together, Frank.
No kidding.
You know, of course, John Podesta has been charged with distributing $370 billion of that money to the climate change industry. And of course, he's been engaged in that and lining his own pockets with that for decades.
What could possibly go wrong? Right.
Well, yeah.
Former White House chief of staff, among other things.
But as you know, I was an old private equity practitioner. I sort of thought it was the last bastion of hard-headed capitalism, where instead of stakeholder capitalism, you had good old-fashioned shareholder capitalism. Well, that's no longer the case, at least if you follow Bain and McKinsey and the others closely, which unfortunately I do.
And of course, the agenda here, Bill, is to euchre access to capital into means of compelling the rest of the business sector to conform to this so-called ESG agenda. And, you know, we had a very interesting webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger of China today, as a matter of fact, in which we talked about cui bono, the old, you know, who benefits. Cui bono, CCP bono, it turns out, is certainly true of this whole climate change sort of hysteria. And it was fascinating. One of the data points that Myron Ebel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, I think you may have interviewed him.
He was on a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, mentioned on air that the magnitude of the emissions coming out of China, of CO2 and these other harmful things, we're told, exceeds the cumulative output of the United States, the European Union, and India. And yet we are not only turning sort of a blind eye to that, and it's compounding by the day, of course, with more coal-fired plants being brought online all the time, but also, Bill, that we're supposed to redistribute wealth to the Chinese Communist Party because they are a developing nation and suffering from climate change predations at the hands of folks like us.
Well,
we've talked about this before, but it's just crazier and crazier if you look at that kind of statistic.
The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, they just held their COP27 conference, and they declared that the developed world owed reparations to the developing world for all the damage we've inflicted because of climate change. Well, in fact, we have not been inflicting damage. We've been inflicting enormous rises out of poverty throughout the world with our Western capitalism. And the insult here—
And through access to energy. I mean, that's been the most single transformative thing. Right?
Massive, massive increase in wealth. But the insult here is that included in the developing countries are China. So we not only buying all our wind and solar equipment from China, we're not only ignoring that they're building a coal-fired plant every week, but we're now supposed to give them reparations because we've damaged the climate, when in fact, as you point out, they're the biggest single emitter of all this supposedly bad stuff. We can have a different conversation about whether CO2 is really all that bad, but that's if you accept that as the predicate, they're among the worst offenders.
Well, I'm among those, and I think you are too.
Yeah.
As in fact, every member of our audience is an emitter of CO2 ourselves. I'm rather partial to being allowed to continue to do it when we exhale, for example, you know? Let me just say, this particular webinar is about the climate change scam and this particular wrinkle in it that we're going to be funding people who are part of whatever problem there is here. It's available at presentdangerchina.org, and I really urge people to take a look at it. It's part of this webinar series that we're doing for the Committee on the Present Danger China that is very compelling about the kind of warfare that's being waged against us by the CCP. Bill, very quickly in closing, as you look at these sort of riots and demonstrations and so on, are you of the view, as I fear am I, that we're likely to see this crackdown being very ruthless and decisive and keeping the party afloat?
Yes. I mean, they're using all their digital tools to track all the protesters down. And, you know, we've talked before about the vaccine. They don't have vaccine cards. They've got health cards that go red, green, and yellow. And they've got all the protesters with red in their cards. So they're using their digital technology and also just the good old-fashioned stormtroopers, which they ominously dress in white. And so they're
and
already...
And the military more broadly. Yeah. Bill, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time today, my friend, for the great programming that you're doing at the Bill Walton Show and for your visits with us each week. We'll look forward to the next one. We're going to talk next with David Bernstein, professor at George Mason University School of Law, about classifications, racial classifications, what they mean for you, right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're going to go into a, well, new field for me, and perhaps for many of you as well, with a man who has been studying it closely. He calls it racial classification in America, and it's a subset, I think, of a larger problem that we're having with kind of resuscitating the whole racist syndrome. And we wanted to talk with David Bernstein, a professor at the Scalia School of Law at George Mason University, about the phenomenon of identity politics now suddenly breathing new life, I would say, into some of the darkest periods of our country in terms of racism. David, it's great to have you with us. Welcome to Securing America. And talk to us a little bit about what you mean by racial classification and how it's manifesting itself.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me here. So all of us are familiar with the racial boxes that we have to check in our daily lives. You register your kid for school, you apply for a mortgage, you go to get to the doctor to get a COVID vaccine. They ask you first if you're Hispanic or not, and then which of five different races that you identify with. And we've come to sort of just get so used to this that we never really think about several things. Why do we have to check these boxes to begin with? Where do these classifications come from? Why these? Why do we, you know, why are Asians but not Arabs or whatever? How are they defined? And is it really just self-identification? I think most of us believe, as I believe before I researched this book, that in theory we could just, you know, that no one's telling us what race we are. We could check whatever we want. But it turns out there are official government rules that were invented in the 1970s. They do have official definitions. And at least in some cases, you can get in trouble for claiming that you are a member of X group. And then some hearing officer and some administrative agency says, wait, you applied to be a minority business enterprise. You said you're Hispanic, but your name's Bernstein. Prove to us. And if not, you're out.
Well, Elizabeth Warren comes to mind, Pocahontas fame, of course. The book is classified, as you call it, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. And you're basically documenting a syndrome that suggests that if you have a drop of a certain type of blood in you, you have a claim, maybe over generations, to be part of some group that could, in fact, under this present arrangement of quotas and preferential treatments, affirmative action, what have you, qualify you to have some of those benefits, no?
So we have to go back. You know, these classifications were dictated by the government back in the early 1970s. And at the time, the United States was primarily a country of white people and black people, very few Asians, very few Native Americans, and Hispanics were generally considered to be white. So no one really thought about that much because of the historic divisions between black and white. Everyone sort of knew who was white, who was black, and we thought at least for a long time those divisions would be out there. What no one really anticipated was, number one, that we have massive immigration from Africa, Latin America, Asia, making all of these categories increasingly arbitrary and weird because they include, like in the Asian category, a Pakistani and a Filipino, that there'd be a huge increase in tolerance, which would in turn lead to a huge increase in interracial marriage. So you have all sorts of people who have, you know, one Mexican grandfather or one Asian niece or whatever. And the question is, well, what do you do with these people? And we stick them into a single box. I mean, you're allowed to check more than one box now, but that was a big fight in the 90s. But oddly enough, even if you check more than one box, the government then says, well, if you are black and white, you're black for statistical purposes. If you're Asian and black, you're black. If you're Asian and white, you're white. So we've gone to this rule that really does go back to racist times and sort of a one drop rule. If part of you is a member of one of these official minority groups, then you are a member of that group.
Fascinating. And to the extent that this does come down to a drop of blood, you mentioned that, you know, there was an increase in tolerance in the 70s and thereafter. Well, that wasn't an accident. That was a result of the civil rights movement and the laws that were promulgated as a result of it. And really, I think a national commitment to promote tolerance and the character of the individual rather than the color of their skin, as Martin Luther King said. How far adrift are we, as you see it now? And I would argue the classification business is a symptom of it, to reverting to some of those racial or racist even tendencies, albeit with, you know, the groups being pilloried or mistreated rather different than they were the last time around.
So ironically, or maybe not so much for those of us who tend to think the government acts in counterproductive ways, the areas where we've had sort of benign neglect, the divisions that we used to have over, say, religion. I'm not quite old enough to remember this, but I'm almost old enough to remember, like, you know, when JFK was running for president, people wondered, could a Catholic actually be elected president? There was a huge controversy, and millions of Protestants who normally voted for Democrats voted for the Republican, and vice versa, because Catholics really felt we want one of our own in there because we face so much discrimination. Now we have a Catholic president, Catholic Speaker of the House, Catholic majority Catholic Supreme Court justice, and it gets very little attention. And people wouldn't have been able to believe that 60 years ago. back in the 60s, sociologists discovered what they call the unmeltable ethnic. They say, oh, we only have a melting pot because look, you go to cities like New York, you still have Italian neighborhoods and Jewish neighborhoods and Polish neighbors and Irish neighborhoods. Well, guess what? 60 years later, the unmeltable ethnics really did melt. And we now just think of all these groups just sort of being white. The area where we've made a lot of progress, but not as much, is with regard to race. And now that is in some ways a thornier situation, but it's also the fact that on the one hand, the increasing tolerance and so forth and the Martin Luther King's dream has really increased all sorts of good measures of how well we all get along with each other, especially interracial marriages and so forth. It used to be 4% of Americans approved of that in 1958. Now it's 95% and almost universal for people under 30. But we have that on the one hand. And then we have the government in really collaboration with elites in the university, in government agencies and NGOs that insist that, no, we must keep classifying everybody by these crude categories. And they do it partly for political power. They want groups form to have constituents. You can get votes this way by playing people off against each other. But there's partly an ideology involved, and the ideology is that America is doomed to always be racially divided, so we must just recognize and make sure each group gets their fair share. And I think that's really a terrible, terribly pessimistic, but also very dangerous for minority groups. I mean, the idea that advocates for minority groups want the country to stay divided permanently is bad for the minority groups. They're in the minority, right? So the more division we have, the more vulnerable they ultimately are.
Yeah. David Bernstein is our guest, a professor at George Mason University and the author of Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. Let me ask you, David, two things. One is you are talking about a phenomenon that I think is also, there's another ideological dimension to it, and that is those who seek to exploit these racial divisions to the detriment of our country. I note that, ironically, the Chinese Communist Party, representing a Han supremacist, racist, you know, sort of culture, is a big promoter of this idea that you know, we have to have critical race theory and the like to sort all this. Point one. And point two, that we now have a case, you're a professor of law, George Mason, we have a case before the Supreme Court in which there is an effort being made to challenge affirmative action at Harvard University and the University of North Carolina. And we've now had the United States military rolling in, claiming that, you know, diversity and effectively quotas are essential to national security. And I wonder if you might sort of talk through those two issues.
Sure. You know, this issue of division and political forces playing on that division, this is why I call and classify the book for moving towards a separation of race and state. And I like that phrase because we all know why we have the separation of church and state. We know that in Europe, before the U.S. was founded, the Protestants and the Catholics and different Protestant denominations were at war with each other, all trying to get control of the government so they could dominate at the expense of the other religious groups. So we said when we founded the United States, you know what, that's the way to solve that problem is not to give the government any authority over religion, and there's nothing to fight about. Same thing with race. Race is an inherently divisive subject, and if you give the government the authority to divide up goodies, basically, to give benefits to people based on race, you will inevitably have people organizing around those racial groups and thinking, where, you know, we want stuff for our group, the other group, so we want, and, you know, and that is not the way to have a unified, happy civil society. That's a way to have become Lebanon, basically.
The military, for example.
Yeah, so. You know, the military, I think, has made a lot of strides in recruiting and retaining black officers and other minority officers. But, you know, this was true even when my dad was in the Army in the early 60s. He told me that he had, you know, black friends in the Army who said they were going to stay there because the Army was the one place where the United States gives you fair treatment rather than the private
meritocracy.
Sector. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. I think that
we've gotten away from that David, I hate to cut you off because this is a topic to which I hope we might return at greater length with you, but this is really vital work, and thank you for this new book, Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. Well, keep up the good work at George Mason University and come back to us with more in the near future if you would. Bill Walton joins us next. We'll talk about China and much more with the great Bill Walton right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back, and I want to say a special welcome to my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy. He directs our Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Project. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He is widely published and highly regarded national security and homeland security professional, and we're delighted to have him with us always. Kyle, thank you for taking the time to join us, and welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Let me start by talking to you about a piece that you had at our Center for Security Policy site, securefreedom.org, about some developments bearing on a group that you've been following closely, and I've testified in Congress about it. You've written extensively, including an important book on the subject of Antifa. Give us an update on this group. A lot of people seem to think it's not a real group at all, but I think the developments you're talking about or provide evidence to the contrary. It certainly is.
That's right, Frank. I was drawn to this because there seemed to be a confluence of events that were all impacting Antifa in interesting ways, and I think may impact the way they operate moving forward. The first was the Colorado Springs mass shooting attack against an LGBT nightclub that took place recently. And a number of people were killed and several people were injured. And this is important because Antifa, on their social media accounts, seized on this incident to try to justify their behavior of conducting armed shows of force outside these so-called drag shows, which sometimes have an audience of children. And these shows have earned a certain level of protest from conservatives and other people on the right, who have a problem with this, and Antifa has taken to physically defending these types of shows with armed force. Most recently in Denton, Texas, there was an example of that in an Antifa group called Elms Fork John Brown Gun Club actually deployed people with AR-15s to quote unquote defend this drag show. And it's important because it shows how Antifa does not really make a distinction between violence of the kind we saw in Colorado Springs, which is obviously something that should be condemned and law enforcement should work, to their utmost to prevent and to investigate. But they don't make a distinction between that kind of violence and First Amendment protected lawful protests of the kind we saw in Texas. They conflate the two and they say that the one justifies the other. So They argue that by conservatives protesting something, it's equivalent to calling for violence and thus justifies Antifa's armed response. And so they took a great deal of support out of that incident. Now, it turns out it's not exactly clear what the motives in the Colorado Spring attack actually were. The alleged perpetrator appears to have filed documents with the court indicating that he's non-binary, which at least at a minimum raises questions as to what his motive actually may have been. But for Antifa's purposes, that's irrelevant. They view the attack as a fascist attack on a community that they are committed to defending. And so this is really being taken as justification for their cause, and I think it's going to motivate them in the future. This builds to the second point, which was a move by Twitter's Elon Musk to ban a number of Antifa accounts online, including that previously noted Elms Fork John Brown Gun Club. This occurred because Elon Musk made a comment about Twitter's terms of service preventing or opposing statements of violence. And then activists, including Andy Ngo from Postmillennial, started to point out to Elon Musk how Antifa accounts engage in calls for violence on Twitter. And then in response, Elon Musk had Twitter ban a number of Antifa accounts, something that in the past has not happened. Despite the fact that Antifa uses Twitter to engage in calls for violence, to organize violence, even so far as to explicitly say, hey, down the street is Andy Ngo, go beat him up, which is, you know, explicit incitement to violence. They have not taken action against Antifa until now. So that was also a very interesting development. The third development—
It took new management at Twitter to do that.
Absolutely, absolutely. The third development—
Third example? Yeah.
Which is related is— a number of guilty pleas in the San Diego Antifa conspiracy to riot case. The Antifa district attorney has prosecuted 11 individuals for a January 2021 riot in which they attacked a number of Trump supporters at a rally and also a bunch of random beachgoers and even a dog. And the San Diego case is the first example that I've seen of a local prosecutor calling Antifa out by name, prosecuting them on conspiracy charges, particularly conspiracy to riot. And in the filings that the district attorney's office in San Diego has put out, they explicitly show how Antifa used social media, including Twitter, to threaten law enforcement officers, to organize protests and riots, and how they explicitly and premeditatedly organized for violence on this particular day. This puts the lie to claims by Antifa and the left that Antifa simply shows up to counter protest and sometimes violence breaks out. That's obviously not the case. They pre-plan violence, they exist to engage in violence, and the San Diego case explicitly shows that. It also shows how Antifa uses social media, such as Twitter, to do this. So that sort of links those three developments together.
It does indeed. Kyle Scheidler is the editor and one of the contributors to Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. And Kyle, I think you're right to point out that we've seen a lot of violence and a lot of evidence of Antifa's responsibility for that violence across this country, notably during the summer of 2020. And it has yet, with the exception, I guess, of this case in San Diego, to be held responsible for it, let alone punished, as others who might have done the same sorts of things, especially on the right, would almost certainly have been. This is a hugely important piece of, I think, the work that should be done by our government to protect the homeland against real domestic terrorist threats instead of the ones they putatively think are of the greatest importance, namely those of conservatives and constitutionalists and veterans and the like. Kyle Scheidler is with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back, and we're going to talk a bit about another aspect of the threat to the homeland from our southern border, what Governor Greg Abbott says he's doing about it. We'll explore whether he is right after this. We're back. We are talking with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, the director of our Homeland Security and Counterterrorism program there, Kyle Scheidler, quite accomplished essayist, analyst, and researcher on matters involving, well, the homeland in the broadest sense. And one aspect of his work is trying to make sure that we properly understand and respond better to the threat now emerging from across our southern border. It's almost hard to say that it is a border any longer. It seems as though it's more or less a thoroughfare for anybody who wants to come to this country and does. Kyle, Governor Greg Abbott has been talking about this problem for some time, notably in the course of his reelection campaign. He's been pressed for some time to describe what's going on at the border as what it is, namely an invasion. I understand he's actually now, in some form or fashion, said that's what we're dealing with and promised to do things about it. Give us a flavor of where this actually stands and what, if anything, is now being done.
Sure. So shortly before Thanksgiving, the governor issued a statement on social media indicating that he believed and would positively declare that the situation at the southern border is justified to be called an invasion. And as a result, under his powers as governor under the Texas Constitution and under the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, he has a right to defend his state from invasion or imminent threat of invasion and could use appropriate force and powers to do that. As, of course,
now,
you know, Frank.
Provided the federal government does not do its job in that regard, or is
so
that
the way the Constitution reads, states are not allowed to utilize war-making powers without the consent of Congress unless actually invaded or under imminent threat of invasion. So what Abbott is saying here is that what is happening on the southern border justifies understanding the situation in that way. I think he's absolutely correct about that. But it's important when we talk about what's happening on the southern border as an invasion, we talk about the national security threat that is represented. We're talking about narco insurgencies represented by the cartels that have links to foreign governments, including the Chinese Communist Party, which enables the flow of fentanyl, which has killed over 100,000 Americans. We're not necessarily, when we're talking about invasion, talking about people who are traveling to America for an economically better life. They are a consequence of the invasion being carried out by the narco insurgency in Mexico and on the southern border. So if we think about it in those terms, we think about the cartels, the armed groups, the traffickers, they're the invasion. The migrants are, or the illegal aliens are a element of that or a condition of that which makes the invasion possible. So Abbott has said that he will use the National Guard to repel or turn back, those were the words that he used, the flow of migrants so that he could deal with the threat posed by the cartel and posed by the smuggling of fentanyl and the human trafficking and the other related threats. This is connected to other statements that he has made, for example, declaring the Mexican cartels to be terrorist groups and a national security threat. So seen through that lens, yes, the southern border is an invasion. It needs to be treated as such. Now, what Abbott hasn't done thus far, and which I think he needs to do if he is going to take this line of behavior seriously, is he we have to actually see the National Guard in Texas ordered to turn back illegal aliens, and we'll see if that in fact occurs. And secondly, we need to see how he's going to deal with Congress. He needs the consent of Congress, or at least he needs to see Congress not declare that there is no invasion. Right? Because he can only operate with the consent of Congress. So if Congress comes out and files a resolution saying, no, there's no invasion on the southern border, he pretty much, under the Constitution, is out of luck. Right? So I would like to see conservatives in Congress come and take, get Governor Abbott's back and say, yes, we agree with the decision of the Texas governor that the southern border is under invasion. It is under threat by narco cartels, human traffickers, and the like. We understand that as to be an invasion, and the state of Texas is in the right in defending itself in the absence of the federal government. So we do need to see people in Congress step up and defend the statement that Greg Abbott has made down in Texas if he's going to be successful.
Yeah, there's been some talk that contrary to that, during this lame duck session, as it's called, when Democrats still control both the House and the Senate, they will be pushing forward with an amnesty for 11 million illegal aliens in this country. As best I can tell, that number has not changed for decades, despite the, invasion by several million, at least, in just the past 2 years. This is really, I think, at this point, likely to prove to be a much larger amnesty were it to be adopted. Do you have any read, Kyle Scheidler, on whether that is, in fact, now in prospect during this this period when a lot of mischief is being made on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think it, as you pointed out, Frank, it's certainly curious that 11 million number never seems to change, despite the fact that we know that there have been over 2 million crossers in the last couple of years. So, it's part of the sort of dishonest part of discussion. When they start talking about amnesty, that somehow it's always 11 million. It's never going to be more than that, despite the fact that it increases every year. I haven't heard anything about where that stands in terms of whether they're actually going to be successful with that. I would be somewhat skeptical. This Democratic Congress hasn't moved the ball on a lot of things they've been trying to move the ball on. And given that they're in a lame duck, I think you're likely to see the Republicans dig in and say any major changes are going to need to happen after the changeover in the Congress. But you never
From
know.
Your lips to God's ears, say, Kyle Scheidler. We don't know just at the moment, but I expect the worst, honestly. Thanks for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Come back to us with updates on all of this, if you would, Kyle. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us do just that, and that you will now go forth and multiply.